The Long Argument, a concise map of Hindu philosophy, where six old ways of seeing meet modern evidence, by Ganesh Gunasekaran. Truth is one, the wise speak of it in many ways. Rig Veda 1.164.46. A plain map of the classical schools of Hindu philosophy, what they ask you to practice, and what the research says about it. This book is for general education and self-understanding. It is not medical or psychological advice, and it is not a substitute for diagnosis or treatment by a qualified professional. Nothing in it is intended to treat, cure, or prevent any condition. The practices described here are contemplative practices, not clinical interventions. For most people, they are safe. For some people, in some conditions, they are not the right tool and can make things worse. If you are dealing with depression, anxiety, bipolar disorder, trauma, an eating disorder, psychosis, or any other significant mental or physical health concern, please work with a qualified professional and treat anything in this book as something to discuss with them rather than as a replacement for their care. If you are in crisis or thinking about harming yourself, please reach out now. Contact your local emergency number or crisis line. Findahelpline.com and befrienders.org will route you to your country's line. This matters more than any idea in these pages. A note before you read. Before the introduction, three things about how to read this book. On tradition and remaking, this book compresses 2,500 years of Hindu philosophy into a short map, reads it through modern psychology and neuroscience, and extracts practices from systems that were never built to be extracted from. That move costs something every time it is made. A darshana lived inside a language, a teacher, a community, and a way of life. A chapter summary keeps the skeleton and loses the blood. The fuller statement is in the back matter. For now, just know it up front. What follows is useful as far as it goes, and it is not the whole territory. The living traditions are still here, and they carry dimensions this book simplifies away. Oh, on what science can show, part 5 of this book draws on research to show where ancient practice and modern evidence converge. And they do converge more than a skeptic would expect. What the research does not do anywhere is prove the metaphysics. That slow breathing settles the nervous system, does not prove prana is a cosmic energy. That meditation quiets the brain's self-network does not prove there is a pure awareness underneath it all. A brain correlate of an experience is not proof of what the experience means. This book tries to stay on that line, and where a claim crosses it, I say so. On who is speaking and how this was made. I write as a practitioner, not a scholar, and not a guru. I practice inside this tradition. I do not speak for it. The substance here comes from my own notes, my own practice, and my own reading. I used AI tools to help draft and organize it into prose, then edited it and checked the claims. I stand behind what remains, and the errors that remain are mine. None of that asks for your trust. Edited it and check the claims. I stand behind what remains, and the errors that remain are mine. None of that asks for your trust. Read closely. Notice where claims are hedged and where they are not, and test what can be tested. That is the method the tradition itself demands, as the chapter on the logicians will make clear. With those three things said, the map is old, the argument is still live, and you are invited into it. Introduction: this is a book about an argument, the longest continuously running argument in human history. It began in India somewhere around the 8th century before the Common Era, when the first Upanishadic teachers started asking what the self is and whether suffering has an exit, and it has not stopped since. Along the way, it produced logicians and atomists, atheists and theists, monks and householders, and at least six complete systems of philosophy that disagree with each other about almost everything except that the argument matters. I wrote this book because the argument is usually presented as a conclusion. Hindu philosophy says all is one. It says no such thing, or rather, one of its schools says that at length and brilliantly, while three other schools spend centuries explaining why it is wrong. Flattening the argument into a slogan loses the best thing about it, which is the arguing, the tradition institutionalized disagreement. Usak classical text states the opponent's position at full strength before answering it. So fairly that scholars now use those summaries to reconstruct rival works that were lost. A tradition that careful about its enemies deserves better than a fridge magnet. The word for a school of philosophy here is darshana, from a root that means to see. A darshana is a way of seeing, and seeing is something you do, not something you believe. So every school in this book comes with a practice. The thing it asks of you, because in this tradition, a philosophy that does not change how you live is considered malformed. Even the logicians open their treatises by claiming that clear knowledge leads to liberation. Nobody here is doing metaphysics for sport. Some of you will have read my earlier books on this path, The One Who Notices and the Practical Yoga Sutras, which walk Patanjali's eight limbs slowly and in detail. This book is the map. Those books sit on, wider, faster, and shallower by design. Where they overlap with this one, in the chapters on the yoga school and on ethics, I keep it brief here and point you there. If you have not read them, nothing in this book requires them. A word on the metaphysics. Since this is where books like this usually ask you to believe things, I am not going to whether Brahman exists, whether awareness survives the body, whether karma runs across lifetimes. These are questions I hold open, and you are free to hold them open too. What I will not do is pretend the questions are settled in either direction or dress the metaphysics in borrowed physics to make it look proven. The practices work or do not work on their own terms, in your own experience, and part 5 is there, so you can see what the actual evidence says before you commit an hour of your morning to any of it. And a word on honesty about the tradition itself, because reverence without honesty is just marketing. This tradition contains extraordinary things. The world's first systematic logic of debate, an atomic theory, a psychology of suffering that modern clinical science keeps rediscovering, and a body of contemplative technique that laboratories are still catching up with. It also contains things its own reformers spent centuries fighting, and a modern layer of pseudoscience that buries the real achievements under fake ones. I have tried to show you the gold and name the rest plainly. The tradition's own logicians would accept nothing less. and the materialist school you will meet in part 3 would accept considerably less than that. Here is how to use the book. Part 1 gives you the terrain, what this tradition is, where its texts come from, and the 8 words that open the rest. Part 2 walks the 6 classical schools, 1 chapter each. Part 3 adds what the standard tour leaves out. The atheists, the devotional revolution that started in the Tamil country, and the tantric current that most modern practice quietly descends from. Part 4 turns it all into a life. 4 paths matched to 4 temperaments, a daily practice, a way of making decisions, and a way of holding laws. Part 5 is the evidence kept honest. Every chapter closes with one concrete practice. You do not need to do all of them, and trying to will guarantee you do none. Pick what meets you where you are and hold it for a season. The map was only ever for the walking, but this particular map is also worth admiring for a moment before you set out, because it took 100 generations to draw. And they argued over every line. Start here. If you have come to this book with a specific need, do not read your way in from the beginning. Pick the entry that matches and come back for the rest. If you want the ideas first, the intellectual map, start at chapter 1 and read straight through. The book is built in that order. If you want practice first and theory later, start with chapter 15, the daily architecture, and begin tomorrow morning. The philosophy will still be here. If you are skeptical and want to see the evidence before you spend a single morning on this, start with part 5, chapter 18, and work forward from there. The book was written expecting you. If you are facing a hard decision, go to chapter 16. Which turns the tradition's idea of dharma into a usable decision procedure. If you are grieving or holding a loss or afraid of one coming, go to chapter 17. It is short and it is the chapter I would want first in that state. If you already practice and want to understand what you practice, part 2 is the spine. 6 schools, 6 chapters. Each ending with what the school asks of you. If you are struggling, and what is loud right now is your own mind rather than a question about philosophy, this may be the wrong book for today. The One Who Notices was built for that, and its opening chapters include a safety map this book only summarizes. The back matter here has a short section called When to Seek Help. If anything in it sounds like you, that comes first. Wherever you enter, hold it the way the tradition holds everything. Do the practice consistently and let go of how fast it works. The pocket card. The whole book on one card. Come back to it whenever you get lost. The question everyone is answering. What is real? What am I? Why do I suffer? And is there a way out? The 6 classical schools, in one line each. Nyaya, know how you know, logic, evidence, and debate. Liberation through clear knowledge. Vaisheshika, know what exists, atoms, categories, a real external world. Samkhya, you are the watcher, not the watched. Consciousness and nature are two, and suffering is mistaking one for the other. Yoga, Samkhya with a method. 8 limbs from ethics to absorption. Mimamsa, duty done well, is the point, not a stepping stone. The philosophy of action. Vedanta, the self and the absolute, and the fight over whether they are one. Shankara, one with distinction, Ramanuja, or two forever Madhva. The loyal opposition, Charvaka, the materialist. One life, no soul, show me the evidence, kept everyone honest for 1,000 years. The four paths, matched to temperament, action, karma, devotion, bhakti, knowledge, jnana, meditation, raja. Same summit, different roads, and the right road is the one that fits your failure mode. The daily minimum, a steady seat, 5 minutes of slow breath with a long exhale, 10 minutes of attention on one object, and an honest evening review. Everything else is extension. The rule that governs all of it. Practice steadily, release the results. Both wings, always. Part 1. The terrain. This first part is the map before the walking. What this tradition actually is, where its words live, and the small vocabulary that opens all of it. I spent years reading around this territory before anyone gave me the plain version of what follows, and the lack of it made everything else harder than it needed to be. So we start here. Chapter 1. An argument, not a creed. Hinduism is a modern administrative label coined by outsiders to name whatever was happening on the far side of the Indus. The tradition's own name for itself is Sanatana Dharma, the enduring order, and its intellectual core is not a creed, but a set of questions. What is real? What is the self? Why do we suffer? What is worth doing? Is liberation possible? And how? Six classical schools answered these questions while accepting the Vedas as at least nominally authoritative. Nyaya, Vaisheshika, Samkhya, Yoga, Mimamsa, and Vedanta. Alongside them ran the schools that rejected Vedic authority outright, Buddhism, Jainism, and the materialist Charvaka. The orthodox and the heterodox sharpened each other through a millennium of public debate, and much of what is best in the orthodox schools was forged answering Buddhist objections. This was not a tradition talking to itself. It was a tradition in a permanent argument with its most serious critics on stages where kings kept score. Three features distinguish it from Western philosophy, as usually taught, and they are worth fixing in mind before anything else. It is aimed at liberation. Every school, even the logicians, states its purpose as the ending of suffering. Metaphysics is never idle here. The Nyaya Sutras, a treatise on logic and epistemology, open by claiming that correct knowledge leads to freedom. A philosophy that does not change how you live is considered malformed, the way we would consider a medicine malformed if it could not be taken. It is experiential. Claims about consciousness are meant to be tested in first-person practice. The Upanishadic instruction is not believe this, but realize this. Meditation is the tradition's laboratory, and 100 generations of practitioners are its data set. With all the strengths and all the biases such a data set carries. I will come back to those biases in part 5, because they are real. It is plural by design. The tradition institutionalized disagreement rather than suppressing it. The classical format requires you to state your opponent's position, the Purva Paksha, at full strength before you answer it. Debate had formal rules, formal judges, and formal ways to lose, and entire schools rose and fell on the outcomes. Whatever else this was, it was not dogma. So the first correction this book makes is to the assumption most readers arrive with, that Hindu philosophy is a single doctrine to be accepted or rejected whole. It is a toolkit of rival, rigorous positions. You are allowed to think Samkhya is right about the mind and wrong about liberation. You are allowed to practice the yoga school's methods while holding its metaphysics open, which is exactly what I do. The tradition itself mixed and matched this way constantly for centuries. The practice this week, once state a position you disagree with at full strength, in writing or out loud, before you answer it. Not a caricature, you can knock over the version its smartest defender would sign. This is the Purvapaksha discipline, the tradition's entry fee for having an opinion at all. And you will notice two things when you do it honestly. The first is how rarely anyone does. The second is that your own position changes shape slightly in the writing, which is the discipline working. Chapter 2. The text. The literature is vast beyond any one life's reading, but for philosophy it sorts into 5 layers, and knowing the layers turns an intimidating wall into a map. The Vedas, roughly 1500 to 800 BCE, are 4 collections of hymns, ritual, and early speculation. Rig, Sama, Yajur, Atharva. Most schools cite them as authority while engaging very little with their actual content, which is largely liturgical. The philosophical action begins in their final layer. The Upanishads, roughly 800 to 300 BCE, for the principal ones are the Vedas' concluding portions, which is why the school built on them is called Vedanta, the end of the Veda. Here the great equations are first proposed that Atman, the self, is Brahman, the ground of everything, Tattvam Asi, you are that. 13 principal Upanishads carry most of the weight. If you read the Katha, which stages the whole teaching as a boy questioning death in death's own house, and the Shandogya, which contains the you are, that dialogue between a father and son. The Bhagavad Gita, roughly 200 BCE to 200 CE, embedded in the Mahabharata epic, is the tradition's most read text and its great act of integration. A warrior collapses in moral crisis on a battlefield. His charioteer answers with a synthesis of action, devotion, and knowledge as parallel paths. The Gita's move is to take the renunciate ideal of the Upanishads and relocate it inside an active life. You do not need to leave the world. You need to change your relationship to the results of your work. Part 4 of this book is, in large part, that move unpacked. The Sutras, roughly 200 BCE to 400 CE, are each school's foundational aphorisms. Patanjali's Yoga Sutras, Badarayana's Brahma Sutras, Gautama's Nyaya Sutras, and the rest. Sutras are compressed to the point of unreadability on their own, and that was the point. They are mnemonic anchors for a living teaching, not standalone books. Nobody was ever meant to learn from a sutra without a teacher, which is what remembering when a bare translation baffles you. The commentaries, roughly 400 CE onward, are where the philosophy actually lives. Shankara, Ramanuja, and Madhva built 3 incompatible systems as commentaries on the same 3 texts, the Upanishads, the Gita, and the Brahma Sutras. Sit with that for a moment. The same canon, honestly read, yielded non-dualism, qualified non-dualism, and strict dualism. The text underdetermined the doctrine, the tradition knew it, and the argument was the mechanism by which it coped. One more body of text deserves specific mention and rarely gets it in books like this. The Tamil corpus is not a regional footnote. The Thirukkural, roughly 500 CE, is a masterpiece of practical ethics in 1330 couplets, so studiedly non-sectarian that half a dozen traditions have claimed it. The devotional poetry of the Alvars and Nayanmars 600 to 900 CE, drove the Bhakti revolution that reshaped all later Hindu practice everywhere, and the Shiva Siddhanta school built a complete rigorous theology on Tamil foundation. I write from Chennai, so I will admit the local pride, but the historical claim stands on its own. From roughly 600 CE, the South was not the periphery of this tradition. It was the engine. Chapter 11 makes the case. The practice, choose one primary text and read it slowly this season, a page or a few verses a day with a good modern commentary beside it. If you want my routing, the Gita, if you live an active life and want the whole synthesis, the Katha Upanishad, if the questions of death and self are what brought you here, the Thirukkural, if you want ethics without metaphysics, the first two chapters of the Yoga Sutras, if you practice, slow primary text beats, fast commentary video by more than you would believe, and a season with one text will teach you more than a year of summaries, this book included. Chapter 3. 8 words. The schools disagree on conclusions, but share a working vocabulary, and 8 words are the keys to most of the literature. Learn these once and the rest of the book and most of the tradition opens. Brahman is the ultimate ground of reality, not a god with a throne and preferences, but that from which everything arises, in which it persists, and into which it resolves. Whether Brahman is impersonal awareness, a personal god, or a useful fiction is the central fight of Vedanta, and chapter 9 stages it. Atman is the self, and the word is precise, not the ego, not the personality, not the body, but the witnessing awareness to which all of those appear. The Upanishadic method for finding it is subtraction. Whatever you can observe, you are not because you are the one observing. Body, feelings, thoughts, roles, all observable. So none of them the observer. What does not subtract away is Atman. Readers of The One Who Notices will recognize this as the seer. It is the same word for the same finding. Karma means action. And technically, it is the claim that intentional actions condition future experience. Strip the cosmology and a testable core remains. Actions form habits, habits form character, and character shapes both what happens to you and how you experience it. The extension across lifetimes is a metaphysical claim I hold open. The psychological core is an empirical one, and it is about as well supported as anything in behavioral science. Samsara is the cycle of conditioned existence that karma and craving keep turning. Experientially, it is the wheel you already know, acquire, adapt, crave, repeat. Psychology found the local version and named it the hedonic treadmill. The tradition's claim is that the treadmill is not a quirk of consumer life, but the default structure of an untrained mind. Moksha is liberation, the exit. The schools disagree sharply on what it is, merging with Brahman, eternal communion with God, the isolation of pure consciousness, but agree that it is the highest human aim and that it involves a decisive end to craving-driven experience, not merely a pleasant mood. Dharma is the hardest word here and the most useful. It means simultaneously the cosmic order, your duties in your roles, your personal ethical path, and the specific right action in this specific situation. English has no equivalent, which is telling. Chapter 16 turns it into a decision framework you can run under stress. Guna names the three strands that Samkhya finds in every mental and physical state: sattva, clarity, balance; rajas, agitation; drive, tamas, inertia, dullness. This is the tradition's state diagnostic language, and it is more practical than it sounds. Chapter 6 puts it to work. Pramana is a valid means of knowledge, and the fights over which pramanas count, perception, inference, testimony, and others produced one of history's most sophisticated bodies of epistemology. Chapter 4 is about the school that led that fight. One more structure completes the kit: the Purusharthas, the four legitimate aims of a human life. Kama, pleasure; Artha, wealth and security; Dharma, ethics; Moksha, liberation. Notice what the list does. It legitimizes pleasure and money. The tradition's mainstream position is not renunciation, but sequencing and subordination. Pursue pleasure and wealth within ethics without mistaking them for the final aim. The householder, not the monk, is the default case, which is the opposite of the popular image and a relief to those of us with jobs. The practice: memorize the eight words, actually memorize them, the way you would vocabulary in any language you intended to use. Then run one life for the next 3 days. When a strong want arises, name it in the vocabulary. Is this kama or artha, and is it inside dharma? Is this craving the treadmill turning? The words are not decoration, they are handles. And a want you can name is a want you are no longer entirely inside. Part 2, the 6 ways of seeing. 6 chapters, 6 schools in the traditional pairing: the logicians with the atomists, the dualists with the practitioners, the ritualists with the metaphysicians. Each chapter ends with what the school actually asks of you, because a darshana is a way of seeing, and a way of seeing is practiced, not held. I will say now what took me embarrassingly long to learn. You do not have to pick one. The tradition's own thinkers borrowed across these lines for 2000 years, and the borrowing was the tradition. Chapter 4. The logicians, Nyaya, asked the question underneath every other question: how do you know anything at all? Its founding text, the Nyaya Sutras of Gautama, not the Buddha, the name was common, builds a complete theory of knowledge, inference, and debate, and then makes the move that marks this whole tradition. It claims that clear knowledge dissolves the false beliefs that cause suffering. Liberation through epistemology. I find that opening claim moving in a way I did not expect from a logic textbook. These were people who believed seriously that thinking clearly could save you. Nyaya accepts 4 pramanas, 4 valid routes to knowledge, and the list is worth knowing because you use all 4 daily without auditing any of them. Pratyaksha, perception, direct sensory contact, when the faculties are working and conditions are adequate. Nyaya distinguishes raw perception from perception already shaped by concepts, anticipating a debate cognitive science is still having. Anumana inference, knowledge through a reliable mark. The stock example runs: smoke on the hill, therefore fire on the hill, because smoke is invariably accompanied by fire, as in the kitchen. The invariable link, the vyapti, has to be established by wide observation and, crucially, by the absence of counterexamples. Nyaya then catalogued the ways inference fails, the too broad reason, the contradictory reason, the unestablished premise, with a precision that maps almost one-to-one onto a modern fallacy list. Upamana comparison, knowing through similarity, as when you identify an animal you have never seen from a description you have. Shabda, testimony, knowledge from a reliable speaker. This is the one to sit with, because Nyaya's treatment is hard-headed. Testimony is valid only when the source is competent about this specific matter and free of intent to deceive. Reliability is earned domain by domain, and the later Nyayikas applied the standard to scripture itself, defending its reliability with arguments rather than assuming it. A tradition that makes its own scripture pass an admissibility test is not the tradition you were told about. Nyaya's second great contribution is formal debate theory. It distinguishes honest joint inquiry, vada, from disputation aimed at victory, jalpa, and from pure destructive wrangling, pitanda, and it lists the moves that lose a debate outright. Shifting your thesis mid-argument, equivocating on a term, answering a question that was not asked, repeating yourself as if repetition were argument. I keep this list somewhere I can see it, and I will just say that reading it against a modern common thread or against my own conduct in a bad meeting is a humbling exercise. Most public discourse would be disqualified in the first round, and so on bad days would I. Where Nyaya leads the modern world, almost nowhere in content, because modern logic and epistemology caught up and passed it, and honesty requires saying so. Where it still leads is in purpose. Modern critical thinking is taught as a defensive skill, a way to not be fooled. Nyaya taught it as a liberative one. The false beliefs you hold about yourself and the world are load-bearing for your suffering. And dismantling them carefully is not pedantry. It is mercy. That framing changes how the tools feel in the hand. The practice, run a belief audit on paper once this week. Take three beliefs that matter to you about yourself, your work, another person, and write next to each one which Pramana delivered it. Direct experience, sound inference, with counterexamples actually checked. Or testimony. And if testimony is the source genuinely competent and honest about this specific domain, be prepared for the finding I get every time I do this. Most of what I call knowledge is testimony. Wearing knowledge as clothes, and some of it is testimony from sources, I would not trust to recommend a restaurant. Nyaya's discipline is knowing which of your beliefs you have actually earned and holding the rest more lightly. Chapter 5. The Atomist. Vaisheshika asks the other foundational question. What kinds of things exist? Its founder is remembered as Kanada, the atom eater, which was probably a nickname and possibly a joke. And his school's most famous claim is atomism, arrived at independently of the Greeks in the same broad ancient window. The argument for atoms is a small piece of reasoning I have never stopped admiring. Division of matter cannot go on forever, because if it did, a mustard seed and a mountain would each contain infinitely many parts, and things with the same number of parts should not differ in size. Therefore, division bottoms out in partless minima, paramanu, atoms. Atoms are eternal, their combinations are temporary. The visible world is assembly and disassembly. The physics is wrong in the details, and the reasoning is beautiful in the structure. And both of those things are true at once, which is a combination this tradition will hand you repeatedly. Around the atoms, Vaisheshika built a categorical inventory of everything that exists: substance, quality, motion, universal, particular, inherence, and added later, absence. Treating absence as a real category sounds like scholastic filler, until you notice that there is no coffee in the cup is a true statement about the world. And a complete theory of reality has to account for what makes it true. 20th century analytic philosophy reinvented this debate at length without knowing it was a rerun. One detail from its list of substances has aged startlingly well. Vaisheshika counts mind manas as an instrument and holds that it is atomic in size, connecting the self to only one sense at a time. This, the school argues, is why you cannot fully attend to two senses at once. The mind must shuttle between them, swap the vocabulary, and you have the attentional bottleneck, the serial nature of focal attention, which is settled cognitive science. They got there by introspection, watching attention flicker between the ear and the eye. And I find that a better advertisement for careful introspection than most of what is written in its defense. Vaisheshika eventually merged with Nyaya, logic and ontology, folding into one school, and together they form the tradition's realist, analytic, proto-scientific wing. Their standing importance is as a rebuttal you can hold in one hand. Whenever someone tells you, Indian philosophy is uniformly mystical. Here is a school that argued for atoms, catalogued categories, treated the external world as solidly real, and considered all of it a road to liberation. The practice decomposition. Vaisheshika's native move on one confusing thing this week, a stalled project, a recurring argument, a mood that will not name itself. On paper, ask what it is actually made of. Which parts, which qualities, which relations between them, and which single part is doing most of the work. The habit of asking, what is this composed of, before asking what should I do about it, is the school's living residue, and it is remarkable how often the second question answers itself once the first is done properly. Chapter 6. The Watcher and the Watched. Samkhya is probably the oldest system and certainly the most influential. Its concepts run underneath the Gita, the entire yoga school, Ayurveda, and most of what came later. Two facts about it surprise almost everyone. First, in its classical form, it is atheistic. No creator, God appears in its foundational text, and later Samkhya argues explicitly that none is needed. Second, it is a dualism, but the line is not drawn where Descartes drew it. Descartes split mind from body. Samkhya splits consciousness from everything else, and everything else includes the mind. Thoughts, emotions, memories, the intellect, the ego, all of these are prakriti, nature, subtle matter, objects that appear. Purusha is the awareness to which they appear. It does nothing, changes, never, and only witnesses. Prakriti does everything and is witnessed. Your anger is on the same side of the line as a rock. The only thing on the other side is the seeing. Suffering, on this analysis, is a case of mistaken identity. Awareness identifies with what it watches. I am this anger, this failure, this body, this career. Liberation, which Samkhya calls kaivalya, aloneness, is the permanent recognition that the watcher was never any of the watched. The show continues. The confusion ends. Readers of The One Who Notices will recognize this as the metaphysics under the seer, because Patanjali took it from here almost without modification. Samkhya's other great export is the guna theory, and this is the part I use daily. Prakriti has three strands present in every state of mind and body: sattva, clarity and balance; rajas, agitation and drive; tamas, inertia and dullness. Every mental state is a mixture. The sharp focus of a good morning is sattva dominant. The caffeinated 3 p.m. scramble is Rajas. The midnight scroll you cannot stop is Tamas wearing Rajas's gloves. And the model predicts transitions. Rajas burns down into Tamas. Tamas is lifted by controlled Rajas, which is why movement helps a dull mind before analysis does. Sattva is approached by calming Rajas and clearing Tamas, never by force. As folk psychology goes, this is unusually good. A three-axis state model with transition dynamics, 2,500 years before affective science built its arousal and valence models, which the gunas loosely resemble. The mapping is inexact, and I will not oversell it. What I will say is that the guna vocabulary trains a habit modern life badly needs. Diagnosing the state before arguing with the content. The 2 a.m. thought does not need refuting. It needs to be recognized as tamas talking and answered with sleep. The practice, two moves, both small. First, state label at transitions. Before a meeting, after a difficult message, when you sit down to work, one silent diagnostic beat in guna terms and one matched response. Rajas dominant, two slow exhales before acting. Tamas, movement before analysis, a walk before a decision. Sattva, proceed and protect the state. Because this is when your hardest thinking should be scheduled. Second, once a day, practice Samkhya's whole philosophy as grammar. When a strong state arises, phrase it as anger is present rather than I am angry. The reframe from identification to observation is the school's entire method compressed into a sentence, and modern clinical work on diffusion trains exactly this move, having rediscovered it under laboratory conditions. Chapter 7. The Eight Limbs. The yoga school is Samkhya turned into a training program. Patanjali's Yoga Sutras accept Samkhya's picture almost wholesale. The watcher, the watched, suffering as mistaken identity, and then do the thing Samkhya never did. Specify the method, step by step, with the failure modes catalogued. I wrote two books on this school. The one who notices walks its second and third thread through the lens of a restless mind. The Practical Yoga Sutras is the complete manual to all four of its chapters. So this one is deliberately the shortest in part two, the skeleton, and where it connects to everything else on this map. The text opens with a definition that doubles as the thesis of the entire tradition's practical wing. Yoga is the stilling of the turnings of the mind. Then the seer rests in its own nature. The rest of the time, we are identified with the turnings. Two lines, the whole system. Awareness mistakes itself for mental activity. Quiet the activity, and the mistake becomes impossible to sustain. The method is the eight limbs. Restraints toward others, yama. Observances toward oneself, niyama. A steady seat, asana. Breath regulation, pranayama. Withdrawal of the senses, pratyahara. Concentration, dharana. Meditation, dhyana. Absorption, samadhi. Three structural points matter for this book's map. The ordering is an argument. Ethics comes before technique because a mind churning with deception, harm, and grasping cannot settle. The yamas are prerequisites, not commandments. The tuning of the instrument before the playing. Breath comes before attention because the breath is the one accessible handle on the involuntary nervous system. A claim part 5 examines and largely vindicates. And concentration, meditation, and absorption are presented as one skill at three depths, not three techniques, which is why I can't meditate usually means I have not yet done the concentration reps. The posture chapter is three sutras long. Patanjali's entire instruction for the body is a seat that is steady and comfortable. The gymnastic postural yoga of the modern studio is largely a later development from the tantric and hatha lineages. Chapter 12's territory. It is a fine thing, and it is not what this text is about. The sutras spend their pages on attention. And Patanjali is the tradition's great phenomenologist of failure. He lists the obstacles, sickness, doubt, laziness, craving, instability, their bodily symptoms and countermeasures, including a social prescription I have found more useful than most therapy adjacent advice. Toward the happy, friendliness. Toward the suffering, compassion. Toward the virtuous, gladness. Toward the harmful, equanimity. Each attitude is matched to the poison it prevents: envy, distress, resentment, rage. He frames it explicitly as mental hygiene, protection for the practitioner's own stability, which is what makes it usable on days when saintliness is not available. The practice, the 3-minute sit, the same one that opens the one who notices, because it is the gateway to this entire school. Sit steady and comfortable. Attend to the breath. When the mind wanders, and it will within seconds, notice without commentary and return. The return is the repetition. Count returns as reps, not failures. A mind that wandered 100 times and came back 100 times did not fail 100 times. It trained 100 times. If this school is your school, those 2 books walk the whole path at walking pace. And chapter 15 of this one gives the daily architecture, the limbs fold into chapter 8, the work itself. Purva Mimamsa is the school every modern survey skips, and I understand why. On its face, it is a hermeneutics of Vedic ritual, a jurisprudence of sacrifice, and nobody is coming to Hindu philosophy for that. Skipping it is still a mistake. Underneath the ritual casing is the tradition's most radical philosophy of action, and for centuries, this was the most institutionally powerful school of them all. 3 positions define it, and each lands harder than its packaging suggests. First, the primacy of action. Mimamsa holds that the point of the Veda, and by extension the point of a life, is not knowledge, but action. Dharma is what is to be done, against the schools that treat the world as something to see through or escape. Mimamsa is flatly world-affirming. Early Mimamsa barely discusses liberation at all. The goal is the right performance of one's duties and the flourishing that follows. And when your obligations are done well, that is not a consolation prize for missing enlightenment. That is the point. There are days, honestly, when I find this the most livable philosophy in the book. Second, the innocence of knowledge, svata pramanya. A cognition counts as knowledge. Unless a specific defeater shows up, you do not verify the floor before walking on it. You walk and revise if it creaks. Mimamsa generalizes this into a full anti-skeptical epistemology, and its practical corollary is a functioning life. Endless verification is paralysis. So the burden of proof sits on doubt, not on belief. Notice the quiet disagreement with Nyaya's audit, everything instinct. And notice that you need both, Nyaya for the beliefs that matter, Mimamsa for the 10,000 that just need to carry weight today. Third, and this is the one I carry around, Apurva, the unseen efficacy of completed action. A ritual performed today bears fruit later. Something must bridge the gap. Mimamsa names the bridge Apurva, a latent potency created by the completed act. Strip the ritual context And a general principle remains that anyone who has built anything will recognize correct action creates real but invisible intermediate states in skill, in trust, in systems, in character that mature into visible results on their own schedule. The work disappears for months. Then the results arrive at once and everyone calls it sudden. Mimamsa also built the tradition's most rigorous theory of interpretation. Rules for ranking direct statement over implication, context over the isolated sentence, the principal clause over the subordinate. Indian jurisprudence absorbed these rules wholesale, and they are still visible in how Indian courts read statutes today, which makes Mimamsa the one darshana you can encounter in a modern legal judgment. The practice pick one duty this week that is genuinely yours and perform it completely with precision without checking for results, credit or acknowledgement afterward. Not a grand duty, a real one. The report finished properly, the parent called, the promise kept in full rather than in spirit. Then, and this is the actual practice, decline to audit the outcome. Mimamsa's wager is that identity is built from completed obligations and that the results, apurva-like, keep their own calendar. In a life run by dashboards, one deliberately unmeasured duty a week is a stranger and more clarifying discipline than it sounds. Chapter 9. The end of the Veda. Vedanta means end of the Veda, the school that takes the Upanishads as the decisive teaching. It became the dominant darshana, and today it is what most people mean by Hindu philosophy. But Vedanta is not a position. It is a family feud. Three rival systems built on the same three texts. And the feud is the most instructive thing about it. The shared problem, the Upanishads say both that Brahman is one without a second, and that the world and individual selves exist. How can both be true? Three great answers, three centuries apart, each from a commentator of genius. Advaita, non-dualism. Shankara, around 700 CE. Only Brahman is real. The world of multiplicity is Maya. Not a hallucination, but a misreading, real at its own level, and false at the final one. The stock analogy is the rope seen as a snake in dim light. The snake is genuinely experienced. Your pulse spikes, you jump, and it was never there. Likewise, the world of separate cells and objects is vividly experienced and is finally Brahman misperceived. Atman is not part of Brahman or similar to Brahman. It is identically Brahman, and liberation is not a change in reality, but a correction in knowledge, like recognizing the rope. Shankara's system is austere, argumentatively dazzling, and dominant in modern presentations, partly because 19th and 20th century reformers exported it to the world as the tradition's essence, which the other two schools would want you to know it is not. Vishishtadvaita, qualified non-dualism. Ramanuja, around 1100 CE, writing in the Tamil country as heir to the Alvar devotional poets. He found Advaita defective both logically and religiously, and his opening objection still lands. If the world is a misperception, whose is it? Brahman cannot err. And on Advaita's own terms, nothing else exists to do the erring. His alternative reality is one, but internally differentiated. Souls and world are real, and they are the body of God, related to Brahman as your body is to you. Liberation is not merger, but eternal communion with a personal God, reached chiefly through bhakti, devotion and prapati, surrender. Where Shankara's last word is knowledge, Ramanuja's is love, and he built the full scholastic machinery to defend love's metaphysics in open debate. Veda, dualism. Madhva, around 1250 CE, went further. The differences are real and permanent. Five distinctions are eternal. God from soul, God from matter, soul from soul, soul from matter, matter from matter. No identity, no merger, ever. Madhva's system is a rigorous theism, structurally closer to the Abrahamic theologies than anything else in the tradition. And his insistence that souls differ intrinsically in their capacities is the tradition's bluntest rejection of one-size-fits-all spirituality. Later teachers staked intermediate ground, and the debates among all of them fill libraries. But step back and notice what the fight is actually about. All parties accept Brahman, Karma, and liberation. The dispute is the final relationship between the self and the absolute. Identity, communion, or eternal distinction. Put in plain terms, it is the deepest question there is about persons. Is your individuality a mistake to be seen through, a relationship to be perfected, or a fact to be honored forever? I do not know the answer. I noticed that the tradition's three greatest minds read the same books and split three ways, and I take that as permission to hold the question with more patience than certainty. The practice, two forms per, the two temperaments this school splits along. Run the one that is not natural to you at least once as a corrective. The Advaita form is the subtraction inquiry. Think quietly. Notice that body, feelings, thoughts, and roles are all things you can observe, and whatever you can observe, you are not. Rest for a few minutes as the observing itself. And when you are pulled back into the contents, return. The Bhakti form from Ramanuja's side of the family. Call to mind concretely three things in your life that you received and did not earn. And let the register be gratitude rather than analysis. Close with one sentence, releasing the day's outcomes to whatever you can honestly release them to. The first practice loosens the grip of the contents.
The second loosens the grip of the controller. The schools fought for 1,000 years over which loosening is final. You are allowed to use both by Thursday.
Part 3. The wider field. The six schools are the classical syllabus, and a map that stops there is a map of the faculty lounge. Three more currents shaped what this tradition actually became. The materialists who kept everyone honest, the devotional revolution that started in the Tamil country and conquered everything, and the tantric stream that most modern practice quietly descends from. This part is shorter than it deserves to be, and it is here because leaving it out would be the polite kind of lie. Chapter 10. The Loyal Opposition. Every serious tradition needs its internal atheist, and Hindu philosophy kept one on staff for over 1,000 years. The Charvaka school, also called Lokayata, the worldly ones, accepted exactly one pramana, perception. If inference, they argued, is unreliable, because the invariable connections it depends on can never be exhaustively verified. You have seen smoke with fire many times, never all times. Testimony is worse. Consciousness is an emergent property of matter, arising from the body's elements, the way intoxicating power arises from fermented grain and gone when the body goes. No soul, no karma, no rebirth, no liberation. One life, so live it. The only sensible aims are pleasure and prosperity. The school's own texts are lost. It survives almost entirely in the summaries of its opponents, which, given the Parva Paksha norms of Chapter 1, are probably fairer than most hostile summaries and the opponents took it deadly seriously. Nearly every major work of Nyaya Vedanta and Buddhist philosophy opens its epistemology by answering Charvaka's attack on inference. Because if that attack stands, every other school in this book collapses with it. For a millennium, the materialists were the bar everyone else had to clear, and the sophistication of Indian epistemology is in real part their doing. The lesson I take is not Charvaka's hedonism, which even sympathetic readers find thin. A philosophy of pleasure that has nothing to say about loss is a fair-weather philosophy. The lesson is structural. The tradition treated its most corrosive skeptic as a permanent debating partner rather than a heretic to be burned, and it is a better tradition for it. Any modern engagement with Hindu thought that cannot tolerate a Charvaka in the room, that treats every hard question as an attack, every demand for evidence as Western arrogance, has abandoned the tradition's own standard, not defended it. The practice, Charvaka's discipline, applied once this week to something you hold from this very book. Take one claim you have accepted and ask, in writing, what is the actual evidence and what would I expect to see if this were false? If the honest answer is, I accepted it because it was beautifully said, you have learned something about yourself that Nyaya would also want you to know. Part 5 of this book exists because this question must be asked, and the tradition's own materialists were the first to insist on it. Chapter 11. The Tamil Engine. Between roughly 600 and 900 CE, in the Tamil country, Hindu religion was reinvented from below, and the aftershocks reorganized everything. Wandering poet saints, the Alvars, devoted to Vishnu, and the Nayanmars, devoted to Shiva, composed ecstatic devotional poetry in Tamil, the language people actually spoke, and aimed it at everyone. Among the canonized saints are a fisherman, a washerman, a hunter, and Al, a woman whose songs are still sung across South India every December. The implicit claim was seismic. Access to God requires no Sanskrit, no ritual specialist, no caste standing, and no philosophical training. It requires love. I want to be precise about what this was not, because devotional movement can sound anti-intellectual, and this one generated rigor at a pace the academy envied. Ramanuja's Vishishtadvaita from chapter 9 is the Alvar experience built into a metaphysical system able to fight Advaita to a standstill in formal debate. On the Shaiva side, the Shaiva Siddhanta school did the same for the Nayanmar tradition, constructing a precise theology of three eternal realities, Pati, the Lord, Pashu, souls, Pasha, the bonds that bind them, with liberation as the severing of bonds through grace. Its key text, the Sivajnanabodham, argues its case with full scholastic machinery, and its masters debated Advaitins on equal technical footing while insisting against Shankara that the liberated soul does not become God, but becomes godlike, united in love while remaining itself. Love, they argued, requires two. Beside the theistic schools stands the text I would save from the fire if I could save only one from this chapter, the Rukkural 13th read couplets on virtue, wealth, and love. So studiedly non-sectarian that Jains, Buddhists, Shaivas, and modern secularists have all claimed it, and so compressed that a couplet can carry a whole chapter of ethics. Its persistent theme is that ethics is a technology of flourishing, not a tax on it. Anger guards its owner worse than it wounds its target. Wealth earned cleanly is an instrument of dharma. A wound from fire heals. A wound from words does not. Growing up with the kural in the air, as anyone raised Tamil does, I mistook its plainness for smallness. It took the philosophy shelf to teach me it belongs on the philosophy shelf. Why this chapter matters to the map. The bhakti movements settled in practice. The question the darshanas debated in theory. If liberation requires mastery of Sanskrit epistemology, then liberation is an elite possession and the tradition becomes a priesthood with footnotes. The bhakti answer was that the decisive variable is not cognitive sophistication, but the orientation of the heart and the subsequent 1,000 years of Hindu history. North and South ratified that answer. Most living Hindu practice today, the practice in actual homes and actual temples, is bhakti practice. A map showing only the 6 schools is not wrong. It is just a map of where the arguments happened, not of where the people went. The practice, the bhakti core, stripped to what requires no metaphysical commitment. Once this week, express gratitude to a specific person directly and concretely for something specific without bundling it with a request or a joke to diffuse it. Then notice what the expression does to your own state, because that noticing is the mechanism the whole path runs on. Devotion reorganizes the motivational machinery of the one devoted. If you have a devotional life already, the tradition's instruction is simpler and older. Sing. The Alvars did not argue their way to God, and they left the argument better than they found it anyway. Chapter 12. The current underneath. One more stream needs naming, because its influence on modern practice is enormous and almost entirely unlabeled. Tantra, visible in the record from roughly 500 CE, is less a school than a method family with a distinctive wager. The energies the ascetic school suppress, desire, emotion, embodiment, imagination, can be used as fuel rather than treated as leakage. The body is not the obstacle on the path. The body is the vehicle. Its most sophisticated philosophical expression is Kashmir Shaivism, culminating around 1000 CE in Abhinavagupta, one of the tradition's few genuine polymaths, metaphysician, aesthetician, theologian, and the rare thinker equally cited in philosophy and in art criticism. Against Advaita's tendency to treat the world as a misreading to be corrected, Kashmir Shaivism is a non-dualism of energy. Reality is one consciousness whose intrinsic power freely vibrates as the universe. The world is not an error laid over Brahman. It is the play and self-expression of awareness. Liberation is pratyabhijna, recognition. The direct realization that your own ordinary awareness is that awareness at full strength here in this embodied life. Same non-dual conclusion as Shankara, opposite emotional temperature. Where Advaita's world is a rope mistaken for a snake, Abhinavagupta's world is a dance, and you were never in the audience. Practically, Tantra contributed most of what the modern world thinks of as generically yogic visualization. Mantra practice as vibration rather than mere meaning, the energy body maps of chakras and kundalini, and the hatha lineages from which modern postural yoga descends. 2 honest notes are required, and I will make them plainly. First, the chakra system is a phenomenological and symbolic map, elaborated differently across different texts. It does not correspond to anatomical structures, and claims that it does are false. Used as a map of where attention can rest and what tends to be felt there. It is often precise. Defended as anatomy, it is indefensible, and part 5 returns to this. Second, the popular Western equation of Tantra with sexual technique takes a marginal, though real, ritual element and inflates it into the whole. The vast majority of tantric literature is about mantra, visualization and metaphysics and is about as erotic as a grammar. Abhinava Gupta's lasting gift and my favorite idea in this whole part is his analysis of aesthetic experience. He argued that absorbed experience of art, rasa, taste is a temporary sip of liberation. Gripped by a drama or dissolved by a piece of music, the spectator's ego boundaries soften and awareness savors emotion without personal stake. You have had this experience. His claim is that it is not a distraction from the contemplative life, but a window into it, which dignifies a whole domain of ordinary human experience that the ascetic schools wave away and which matches something every serious listener already suspected about music. The practice, Tantra's core instruction, in its safest and most portable form. This week, when one strong experience arrives, a wave of emotion, a piece of music, a meal, a difficult conversation's aftermath. Meet it with full attention instead of managing it. Not suppressing, not indulging, not narrating, attending. The way you would attend to the breath, letting the intensity itself be the concentration object. The technique is the direct ancestor of the modern clinical instruction to turn toward difficult experience, and its wager is checkable in a single sitting. Intensity met with complete attention behaves differently from intensity resisted. Whether it is also, as Abhinava Gupta thought, a sip of something larger, I leave with you. Part 4. Living it. A map you have read is not a path you have walked. This part turns the terrain into a life. 4 roads match to 4 temperaments, the ethics that make practice possible, a daily architecture, a way to make hard decisions, and a way to hold loss. It is the part I would keep if I had to cut the rest. And it is built so that nothing in it requires you to have settled a single metaphysical question from parts 2 and 3.
Chapter 13. 4 roads, 1 summit. The Gita's central practical insight is that there is no single path because there is no single practitioner. The tradition consolidated this into 4 yogas.
4 complete disciplines, routed by temperament, sharing one target, the dissolution of egocentric craving, and differing in which human faculty they use to hit it. I gave the cuisine analogy in The One Who Notices. Mindfulness is French cooking, treated by much of the world as the height of the art, while whole other cuisines sit unexplored. Here is the full menu. Karma Yoga, the path of action for the doer. Act fully, skillfully, according to duty while surrendering claim to the results. The Gita's formula, you are entitled to the action, never to its fruits. This is not passivity. Krishna tells Arjuna to fight and to fight well. It is the severing of one specific linkage between effort and the demand that outcomes arrive on schedule to feed the ego. Performance psychology found the same seam from the other side. Process focus outperforms outcome fixation, and attachment to results degrades both execution and well-being. Karma Yoga is that finding radicalized into a complete spiritual method, with the working world as the gymnasium. Bhakti Yoga, the path of devotion for the lover. Redirect the emotional machinery of attachment from finite objects to an infinite one. Its practices are relational, worship, song, remembrance, gratitude, service, surrender. Its psychological engine is the reorganization of motivation around love rather than fear or acquisition. And you do not need to settle the theology to observe the mechanism. The sustained practices of gratitude and self-transcendent emotion measurably improve well-being, and communal devotional practice adds the protective effects of belonging, which are among the best supported findings in all of health research. The tradition insists this path is complete on its own, not a remedial track for those who cannot do philosophy, and 1,000 years of saints are its evidence. Jnana Yoga, the path of knowledge for the analyst, systematic inquiry into the self, classically in three movements. Hearing the teaching, reasoning it through until the objections are actually resolved rather than suppressed, and then sustained meditative assimilation until it stops being a proposition and becomes a perception. The subtraction inquiry from chapter 9 is its core exercise. The tradition says plainly that this is the steepest road, and it suits the people who cannot not ask. Raja Yoga, the path of meditation for the systematizer. Patanjali's 8 limbs, the direct procedural training of attention through ethics, posture, breath, and graduated absorption. Being the most procedural, it is the most exportable, which is why it is the ancestor of most modern secular meditation and of my own books on it. The four are not exclusive, and the Gita itself blends them. Most practitioners I know, myself included, run a mixture, karma, yoga at work, bhakti in gratitude and relationship, raja in the morning sit, janana in study. The routing question is emphasis. And I have found the honest version of the question is not which path is highest. The schools argued that one to a draw, but which failure mode is mine. The doer's failure is burnout and control. Karma yoga targets exactly it. The lover's failure is clinging. Bhakti retrains it. The thinker's failure is rumination. Jnana disciplines rumination into inquiry. The systematizer's failure is collecting techniques instead of practicing one. Raja's fixed sequence forbids it. The practice, identify in writing your dominant faculty, action, emotion, intellect, discipline, and your dominant failure. One sentence each. Then weight your practice accordingly as you read the next 2 chapters, which give the ethics and the daily architecture the 4 roads share. The tradition's routing advice. Compressed, do not practice the path you admire. Practice the path that fits and admire the others from it. Chapter 14. Ethics. First, every contemplative tradition puts ethics before technique. And the reason is mechanical, not moralistic. A mind carrying active deception, harm, and grasping cannot settle, because settling requires the mind to stop defending things. Patanjali's 10 commitments, 5 yamas toward others, 5 niyamas toward oneself, are the tradition's minimal viable ethics. And since I walked all 10 slowly in The One Who Notices, and again in the Practical Yoga Sutras here, I will give the map and the method and send you to those for the mile by mile. The 5 yamas, ahimsa, non-harm, the root restraint, whose most neglected direction is inward, at the running self-commentary that would be cruelty if aimed at anyone else, satya, truthfulness, calibrated to non-harm, and the most testable of the 10. The commitment to it pulls you into the present, reshapes conduct. The simplest way to never lie about a thing is to not do the thing, and quietly teaches surrender, because most flies are bids to control another person's reaction. Asteya, non-stealing, including the modern thefts of time, credit and attention. Brahmacharya, read for householders as the right use of energy, the refusal to leak yourself in every direction at once. Aparigraha, non-grasping, not poverty, but the loosening of identity from possession. The five niyamas, shoha, cleanliness of body, space and inputs. And yes, the feed is an input. Santosha, contentment, practice rather than awaited, the deliberate registering of sufficiency. The gratitude research is this niyama with a worksheet. Tapas, discipline, the voluntary acceptance of friction, the kept schedule, the cold start, the finished draft, done before the motivation arrives rather than after. Svadhyaya, self-study, the regular structured examination of your own patterns and the slow reading of texts that hold up a standard. Ishvara Pranidhana, surrender, the release of outcomes to something larger, however you can honestly conceive it, and functionally the off switch for the controlling mind. The method for working them comes from Patanjali in a single line, and it is the part to keep even if you keep nothing else. When disturbed by a harmful impulse, cultivate the opposite, Pratipaksha Bhavana. Do not wrestle the impulse which feeds it. Deliberately turn toward the contrary quality and dwell there. Cognitive reframing, named and prescribed 16 centuries before the clinical trials. And it works on the same schedule, not instantly, but reliably with reps. The practice, do not attempt all 10. Attempting all 10 is how you practice zero. Pick the one whose absence is currently most expensive in your actual life. Define one behavioral expression of it, small enough to check daily. Run it for a month alongside the daily architecture of the next chapter and watch for the effect the ordering predicts. The sit deepens in proportion to how little the mind has to hide. That correlation, in your own case, is the chapter's claim made testable. Chapter 15, A Daily Architecture. This chapter compresses the whole tradition's method into a daily protocol. The durations are minimums that produce effects. Extend as capacity grows and hold all of it with the two wings from every tradition worth its salt. Steady practice, loose grip on results. Morning block. 20 to 30 minutes before inputs. The phone stays wherever it charged. First, the seat. 1 minute. Steady and comfortable. Chair entirely acceptable. Spine self-supporting. Hands resting. Patanjali requires nothing more, and neither do I. Second, the breath. 5 minutes. Slow toward roughly 5 or 6 cycles a minute. In for about 4, out for about 6, through the nose, smooth, with the exhale clearly longer than the inhale. This is pranayama's foundation, and as part 5 will show, the component with the strongest physiological evidence in the entire book. Nothing forceful. Breath, retention, and the vigorous techniques need a teacher, and if you carry the cautions listed in the disclaimer, the slow, long exhale form is the only one to use. Third, concentration, 10 to 15 minutes. One object held, and the same object every day this season. The breath at the nostrils or a mantra, a short repeated sound with some personal gravity or a remembered flame. The instruction is identical across objects. Attention on the object. When it wanders, notice without commentary and return. Count returns as reps. This is dharana, the trainable core of the entire system, and everything deeper grows out of it unforced. Fourth, inquiry or devotion. 5 minutes, routed by your chapter 13 answer. The jnana form is the subtraction inquiry. Ask, what is aware of this thought? And instead of answering in words, look. Every answer that arrives is another object appearing to awareness. So notice it and ask again. The exercise ends in a wordless noticing of noticing. And the repeated failure to find a graspable self is not the exercise failing. It is the exercise, the bhakti form. Three concrete, received and unearned things held with actual attention. Then one sentence, releasing the day's outcomes to whatever you can honestly release them to. Daytime, embedded 0 added minutes before significant work, one sentence of intention. What this serves beyond me. During single tasking as tapas, full engagement after, release of the result, which means specifically no relitigating the meeting on the drive home. And at transitions, the guna check from chapter 6 with its matched responses. This is where karma yoga lives and it is practiced here or nowhere. Evening 5 to 10 minutes, the Aswadhyaya review, 3 questions, written beats mental, where did I act against my chosen commitment today? Where did craving or aversion drive a decision? What did I do well that should be repeated? The tone is a mechanics inspection, not a trial. Patanjali's list of obstacles are diagnostic, never damning, and yours should be too. Then, optionally but compoundingly, a few verses of the season's primary text, read slowly. Progression, honestly stated, weeks 1 to 4, establish the morning block at minimums. Consistency outranks duration decisively, and the streak matters more than any single sitting. Months 2 and 3, extend concentration toward 20 minutes, which is roughly where the research effects live. Add one ethical commitment per month. From month 3, expect not fireworks, but a shifted baseline. Quicker recovery from provocation. Earlier noticing of state. A little more space between the urge and the act. Those are the outcomes the evidence supports and the tradition's own promised early markers. The deeper states exist in both literatures. They are not scheduled deliverables, and anyone selling you a schedule is selling. The caution restated because it belongs next to the instructions. Practice at these durations is low risk for most people and not for everyone. Intensive practice, retreat settings, trauma histories and psychiatric vulnerability change the picture, and a minority of practitioners experience real adverse effects. If practice reliably worsens your state, the instruction is not to push through. It is to stop and to bring in a teacher or a clinician. Intensity is not depth, and the when to seek help section in the back matter is part of this chapter. The practice is the chapter. Begin tomorrow morning at the minimums with the closing chapter's 30-day structure if you want the scaffolding. Chapter 16. What should I do? Dharma is the tradition's answer to the question that survives all the metaphysics. What should I do here, now with this? And its structure is more sophisticated than either rule following or consequence calculating. Because Dharma is indexed to your roles, your stage of life, your capacities, and the situation in front of you. The Gita's entire drama is a dharma conflict. Arjuna's duty as a warrior against his duty to kin. And Krishna's response is not a universal rule but a regrounding of action itself. Extracted as a decision procedure, dharmic reasoning runs in 5 moves and I use it on paper for every decision large enough to cause sleep. First, name the roles in play. You are deciding as a parent, an engineer, a founder, a friend, a citizen, and each role carries duties. Most hard decisions are hard because roles conflict, and the fog you feel is usually an unnamed conflict. Write the roles down. The fog thins immediately. Second Order by Eswadharma. The duties that are irreducibly yours. The Gita's sharpest verse. Better your own dharma, done imperfectly, than another's done well. No one else can be your children's parent. Several people could chair the committee. The irreplaceable duties outrank the delegable ones, and a striking number of overcommitted lives are lives that got this ordering backwards. Third, apply the non-harm filter among the available actions, which minimizes harm, counting all parties, counting yourself, and counting omission as an action. This is Dharma's consequentialist checkpoint. It is a filter, not the whole engine, which is what keeps this from collapsing into utilitarianism's familiar traps. Fourth, check the ledger of craving. And this is the move the tradition adds that no Western framework quite has. Would I still choose this if my ego got no credit? Decisions driven by acquisition, fear, or image are craving in a suit. The same external action, chosen as duty, is a different act. Answered honestly, this question reclassifies a humbling fraction of what I used to call strategy. Fifth, act fully and release the result. Once decided, execute with complete commitment and without relitigating during execution. Post-decision, rumination is the mind demanding fruits, and the framework's final discipline is refusing the demand. Two features distinguish this from the frameworks you already know. It is particularist. It expects the right answer to vary by person and role, and treats what would anyone do as the wrong question. The right question is, what should I, in this position, with these obligations, do? And it separates decision quality from outcome quality with unusual firmness. A right action can produce a bad outcome without having been wrong, which decision theorists formally endorse, and human psychology fights with everything it has. Dharma language gives that distinction a handle you can hold under stress, which is when you need it. One limitation, stated plainly rather than footnoted, Swadharma historically encoded caste, and the tradition's internal critics from the Bhakti saints of chapter 11 onward spent centuries attacking that encoding. The extraction offered here follows the reformers. Roles are taken as chosen and circumstantial, never as born. That is a modern reading. I make it openly, and I am far from the first. The practice, take one live decision this week of the sleep costing kind, and run the five moves on paper. Roles named, irreplaceable duties, ranked, harm filtered, the ego credit question answered in writing where you cannot fudge it, then commitment and release. The framework's value is only visible in use, and its most common first finding is that the decision was never actually about what you thought it was about, which the fourth move exposes. Chapter 17. What cannot be lost? The Katha Upanishad stages the tradition's confrontation with death as a story. A boy, Nachiketa, waits three nights in death's own house. Death, embarrassed by the lapse in hospitality, offers boons. The boy refuses wealth, long life, and pleasures. They wear out the fire of the senses, and even the longest life is short, and demands the one answer death does not want to give. What remains? The teaching that follows is the Upanishadic core. The body dies. the witness was never born. You do not have to accept that metaphysics. And this chapter does not ask you to. The tradition's practical handling of impermanence stands on its own, and it converges almost line by line with what the Stoics found in Greece and the Buddhists found next door, which is itself evidence of something. Three independent traditions running the same experiment on human loss, filing the same report. First, rehearsal rather than avoidance. The tradition prescribes deliberate, regular contemplation of transience, possessions, statuses, relationships, this body, all on loan. The purpose is not morbidity, but calibration. Craving and outrage both depend on an implicit assumption of permanence, and the assumption does not survive regular inspection. Modern grief research points the same direction. Avoidance of death thought predicts fragility when loss arrives, and integrated awareness predicts resilience. Second, the vocabulary of stewardship. Everything you hold in trust. What is yours today was another's before and will be another's after. Holding roles, assets, even relationships this way, rather than as organs of identity, is the practical meaning of aparigraha. And it is the difference when change arrives between a loss and an amputation. Change does arrive. The only variable under your control is which of the two it finds. Third, equanimity as a trained capacity rather than a temperament you either have or lack. Samatva, evenness, is the Gita's definition of yoga itself. Evenness of mind is yoga, and the training is incremental in exactly the way strength is. Non-reactivity practiced on small losses, the criticism, the delay, the cancel plan, builds the capacity that the large losses will eventually demand. Every minor initiation is a repetition at low weight. I do not always remember this at the moment of the initiation. Remembering it one time in three has changed more than I expected. The tradition's bet, stated without decoration, a life organized around what cannot be lost. The quality of your attention, the discharge of your duties, and if the Upanishads are right, awareness itself is more stable than a life organized around what must be lost, which is everything else. Notice that the bet pays out even if the metaphysics does not. Attention and duty are loss-proof on any cosmology. The Upanishads further claim that the witness itself survives is the part I hold open and the part Nachiketa waited three nights in death's house to hear. The practice, the tradition's rehearsal, in its gentlest form, once this week, choose one thing you hold dear, an object, a role, a relationship, and spend 2 quiet minutes contemplating concretely that it is on loan. Not that it might be lost, which the mind deflects, but that it will be in the way of all lent things, and that this was always the arrangement then. And this is the whole point. Go to it, use it, or be with it, and notice what the rehearsal did to the quality of the attention you bring. The contemplation of loss, done rightly, is not a rehearsal of grief. It is the sharpest known instrument for producing gratitude. And you can verify that in 2 minutes today. 5. The evidence. This part exists because Charvaka was right that the question must be asked, and because the modern conversation about these practices runs to 2 equally lazy extremes. The enthusiast who says the scans prove the sages, and the debunker who says it is all incense and placebo. Both are wrong, in ways that take about 4 chapters to sort out honestly. I have kept to meta-analyses and the beta trials, flagged effect sizes as the field reports them, mostly small to moderate, which is normal for behavioral interventions and disappointing only to people raised on marketing, and treated single spectacular studies as unconfirmed. The sources are in the back matter, chapter 18, the line. Before any findings, draw the boundary, because both sides blur it constantly and the whole part depends on it. Science can test the practices. Does slow breathing change autonomic markers? Does concentration training change attention performance? Does an 8-week meditation course reduce anxiety against an active control? These are ordinary empirical questions with ordinary answers, some now well replicated, and the next three chapters report them. Science can test the psychology. Claims like disidentification from thoughts reduces their grip. Gratitude practice improves well-being. Process focus outperforms. Outcome fixation are operationalizable and have been studied, mostly under other names. Diffusion, decentering, gratitude interventions, mastery goals, where the tradition psychology has been tested. It has held up remarkably often, and I will say so where it has. Science cannot currently test the metaphysics, whether Brahman exists, whether awareness is fundamental or emergent, whether anything survives death, whether karma runs across lifetimes. These are not empirical questions as presently formulable. No scan adjudicates between Shankara and Madhva. Anyone claiming laboratory proof of the metaphysics in either direction has left science for marketing. And this includes the debunkers, whose confident consciousness is just neurons, is also a bet placed ahead of the evidence, as chapter 21 explains. There is a fourth category, and missing it is the subtlest error on both sides. Phenomenology as data, that trained practitioners across traditions reliably report certain state progressions, absorption stages, the softening of the subject-object boundary in deep samadhi, is itself an empirical fact about human experience, now studied with imaging in advanced practitioners. The reports are data. The metaphysical interpretation of the reports is not settled by the reports. A brain correlate of an experience tells you how the experience shows up in a brain, not what the experience means, and I will hold that line every time it matters in the next four chapters. A note on the quality of the field, because it bears on how much weight anything here can carry. Contemplative science had a weak early phase, small samples, no active controls, enthusiast researchers, publication bias. The correction came from inside the field, most visibly in a 2018 methodological critique, bluntly titled Mind the Hype. And standards have risen since: pre-registration, active controls, adverse event tracking. What follows leans on the post-correction literature wherever it exists. The practice, adopt the four-box sort as a permanent habit. When you next meet a claim about these practices in a book, a class, an app, this book place it. Practice claim, psychology claim, metaphysics claim, or phenomenology report. The first two can be checked. The third cannot currently by anyone. The fourth is real data awaiting interpretation. Most bad conversations about this whole territory are just claims sitting in the wrong box, and the sort takes 10 seconds once it is a habit. Chapter 19. What the research shows. The modern evidence base descends largely from one act of translation, mindfulness-based stress reduction, Jon Kabat-Zinn's 1979 secularization of Buddhist and yogic technique, later joined by mindfulness-based cognitive therapy. What these programs train is substantially the dharana core of chapter 15. Sustained attention to an object with non-judgmental return after distraction. So the findings below are findings about this book's central practice, and I give them in descending order of strength. Clinical outcomes, moderate, real, and specific. The benchmark meta-analysis, Goyal and colleagues, 2014, JAMA Internal Medicine, 47 randomized trials with active controls, found moderate evidence that mindfulness programs improve anxiety, depression, and pain, with effects comparable to what antidepressants achieve in similar populations, and low or insufficient evidence for many broader claims. Mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, specifically, cuts relapse risk by roughly a third to a half in recurrent depression across several trials, most clearly for people with three or more prior episodes, comparable to maintenance medication, and sits in the UK's clinical guidelines for that indication. That is the solid center of the field. Meditation is a clinically meaningful tool for anxiety, depression, and pain, and an unremarkable one for most other advertised targets. Moderate and real is the honest headline, and it is enough. Attention and cognition, positive, modest, dose dependent. Concentration training improves performance on attention tasks. Sustained attention, conflict monitoring, reduced attentional blink. Most clearly in longitudinal studies of intensive practitioners, effects from short courses are smaller and less consistent. The dose response pattern is what the tradition skill acquisition. Framing predicts, though selection effects who persists are hard to fully exclude, and I will not pretend otherwise. Brain changes, real and routinely overinterpreted. The most reliable functional finding, meditation reduces activity and alters connectivity in the default mode network, the midline system that runs self-referential mind wandering. Since that network's hyperactivity tracks rumination and depression, and since reduced self-referential churn is precisely what its identification practice claims to train, this is a satisfying mechanism candidate, and readers of The One Who Notices will recognize it as a network of self from its first chapter. The structural claims are another matter. Early reports of gray matter change from 8-week courses did not survive a large, well-controlled 2022 trial. Honest summary. Functional change with training is well supported. Structural remodeling from short programs is not. And meditation rewires your brain should be retired from the sales deck. Stress physiology. Moderate reductions in cortisol reactivity, blood pressure, and inflammatory markers appear across studies with real heterogeneity. The American Heart Association's assessment is representative and usefully unexcited. Meditation may be a reasonable adjunct for cardiovascular risk, plausible and modest, and no substitute for standard care. Advanced states, the emerging frontier, and the most interesting shelf in the library. Imaging studies of expert practitioners, including recent work on samadhi-type absorption states, find state signatures that are large, unusual, and reproducible within subject. This confirms something worth saying carefully. The deep states the tradition describes are real, distinct neurophysiological events, not exaggeration or legend. What they mean remains exactly as open as chapter 18 says it is. And what does not hold up in one paragraph? Meditation does not reliably produce enlightenment on schedule, does not replace psychiatric treatment, does not extend lifespan dramatically, and does not benefit everyone. Adverse effects are documented and non-trivial. Meditation-related difficulties, from transient anxiety to lasting destabilization, occur in a minority of practitioners concentrated in intensive retreat contexts and vulnerable individuals. The tradition, to its credit, always said the deeper terrain required a teacher. The app economy dropped that clause, and the research on harms is the invoice. The practice? Calibrate your expectations to the evidence in writing. Before your 30 days, what I can reasonably expect from consistent daily practice is a moderate improvement in anxiety, reactivity, and attention on a time scale of weeks with deeper effects unscheduled. Then hold the practice to that standard and not to the posters. Under-promised practice survives. Over-promised practice is abandoned in week 3, and the abandonment gets blamed on the practice. Chapter 20. The Breath and the Body. Pranayama makes the most mechanistically tractable claims in the entire tradition. Because the breath is a genuine physiological control surface, the only autonomic function under easy voluntary command, coupled directly to heart rhythm and vagal tone. My last book called The Breath, The Liver. Here is the engineering report on the liver. Low breathing is the strongest single result in this book. Breathing at around 5 or 6 cycles per minute with extended exhalation reliably and immediately increases heart rate variability and baroreflex sensitivity, markers of the body's calming branch engaging, and lowers blood pressure acutely, with more modest and less consistent durable reductions in hypertensive populations. The mechanism is understood in outline. Slow breathing entrains the cardiovascular oscillations near the baroreflex's resonant frequency around a tenth of a hertz, and the exhale phase locks with vagal slowing of the heart. This is why Chapter 15 front loads a 4-in, 6-out breath. It is the tradition's most directly vindicated technique, full stop. And one detail from this literature gives me disproportionate pleasure. 2001 study in the BMJ found that reciting the rosary and reciting a yogic mantra each spontaneously settled the breath at almost exactly 6 cycles per minute. The traditional recitation practices appear to have converged on the resonant frequency of the human baroreflex empirically centuries before the physiology existed to name it. The contemplatives found the dial by feel. Breathwork for anxiety and stress shows consistent direction and modest magnitude in meta-analyses, with the usual caveats of heterogeneous protocols and small studies. The direction agrees with everything above. The sizes are honest rather than thrilling. The other pranayamas, honestly ranked, alternate nostril breathing, shows acute calming effects in small studies, while the hemispheric switching story attached to it is not well supported. The rapid techniques, Kapalabhati, Bhastrika, genuinely alter arousal upward and can provoke lightheadedness or worse. They are the heavy lifting of this domain, useful with instruction, wrong as defaults, and off the menu entirely for anyone carrying the disclaimer's cautions. Postural yoga, solid for specific things. And the honest gloss is that it behaves in the data like a well-designed exercise system with a mindfulness component. Cochrane-level evidence supports it for chronic low back pain, comparable to other exercise and better than none. Trials support flexibility, balance, and quality of life benefits across populations. Injury rates are low, but not zero, with aggressive styles and hypermobile practitioners accounting for most of the problems. None of this is magic, and none of it needs to be. And the energy body maps, which is where this chapter has to hold two things at once: prana, nadis, chakras, kundalini, As felt experience cartography, these maps are often precise. Interoceptive sensation does cluster along the body's midline. Sustained attention to those regions does modulate state. The maps give that territory names and a syllabus. As anatomy, they are simply false. No instrument detects prana, no dissection finds a chakra, and no credible study says otherwise. The mature position, which is also the position of the tradition's more careful modern teachers, holds both without strain. Use the maps as practice tools and do not defend them as physiology. A map of felt experience does not need to be an anatomical chart to be worth following, any more than heartache needs a cardiologist to be real. The practice, if you adopt one physical technique from this entire book, it is this: 5 minutes daily of slow nasal breathing, in for roughly 4, out for roughly 6, done, whether or not you feel you need it, because the point is the baseline and not only the bad moments. Keep the physiological sigh, 2 stacked inhales, 1 long exhale in your pocket for acute moments. Both are safe for essentially everyone. Both are free, and the first is the best evidenced item in the tradition's entire toolkit. Chapter 21, The Self Under the Scanner. The tradition's deepest claims concern the self and consciousness, and this is the chapter where I have to be most careful, because it is where the convergence is most striking and the temptation to overclaim is therefore strongest. The honest report has 2 halves. The convergence, and it is genuinely remarkable. The Upanishadic and Samkhya analysis holds that the ordinary self is a construction, a bundle of processes, sensation, memory, narrative, the I-maker mistakenly experienced as a single solid entity. Modern cognitive science, arriving by a completely different route, agrees to a degree that still surprises researchers who wander into the comparison. The self of the laboratory is not a thing, but a set of dissociable processes. Bodily self models, autobiographical narrative, agency attribution, each of which can be perturbed independently in illness, in lab illusions, under psychedelics, and in meditation. The self is a process, not an object, is close to consensus cognitive science. And it was this tradition's opening move, made from a cushion 3,000 years early. The default mode findings slot straight in. The narrative self machinery is a specific identifiable, trainable system, and contemplative practice demonstrably turns its volume down. The practical cash out survives every metaphysical outcome, and it is worth stating before the divergence, the tradition's operational claim that deconstructing the constructed self reduces suffering is testable and increasingly tested. Self-referential processing tracks rumination and misery. Interventions that loosen it, decentering, diffusion, meditation improve outcomes, and decentering is now measured as an active ingredient in the clinical trials. You can hold every question about Brahman open and still cash this check, and I do most mornings. Now the divergence, stated without a thumb on either pan. From the constructed self is not ultimate. Advaita concludes that what remains pure awareness is fundamental reality itself. Neuroscience's default working assumption runs the other way. Consciousness emerges from neural processing. Full stop. Here is what an honest observer has to report. The heart problem, why and how physical processing is accompanied by experience at all, remains unsolved. And the life scientific theories of consciousness disagree with each other about as sharply as the darshanas did, complete with public letters of accusation between camps. One prominent theory has consciousness first sympathies its critics call unscientific and its defenders call following the argument. The point is not that Vedanta is vindicated, it is not, and no scan will vindicate it. The point is that materialist emergence is currently a research program rather than a result, and the tradition's contrary bet remains on the table as philosophy, not pseudoscience, exactly as long as it claims no laboratory proof. Both sides of the modern shouting match would benefit from reading the other's Purva Paksha, which is perhaps the most Hindu possible conclusion for this chapter to reach. The practice, the subtraction inquiry from chapter 9, run once with the scanner's findings in mind. Notice that body, feelings, thoughts and roles are all observable and that the observing is not any of them. What the science adds to the old exercise is this, and hold it as you sit. The hundred self you are subtracting has an address in the brain and a volume knob. And the exercise you are doing is, among other things, your hand on that knob. What the silence at the end of the subtraction means, no one on earth can currently tell you, that it reduces suffering to rest there. You can verify by Friday. Chapter 22, where the claims outrun the evidence. A tradition is honored by holding its claims to the standard its own logicians built. So this last chapter of evidence is a short list of popular claims to retire, quarantine, or handle with tongs. Consider it this book's pest control. Quantum mysticism, quantum mechanics, does not say consciousness creates reality, does not mention Brahman, and does not validate Vedanta. The observer effect concerns measurement interactions, not minds. And physicists who are also contemplative say this plainly and often. Vedanta's arguments are philosophical, and some are strong. Dressing them in misread physics does not strengthen them. It announces that the dresser trusts neither the physics nor the philosophy. Medical overreach. Meditation and yoga are adjuncts with moderate, specific, well-documented benefits. They do not cure cancer, replace insulin, or substitute for psychiatric treatment in serious illness, and people have died of those confusions. Traditional medicine systems contain useful practices and also unstandardized preparations with documented contamination problems. Traditional is a provenance, not a safety certificate. Chakras as anatomy, prana as measurable energy, covered in chapter 20, filed here for completeness. Practice maps, not physics. The maps are old, refined, and useful. The anatomical claims are false. Both sentences are true. And maturity in this territory is the ability to hold them simultaneously. Enlightenment on a subscription schedule. The commercial meditation economy implies a staircase with an app at the bottom and bliss at the top on a timeline suspiciously aligned with the billing cycle. The tradition never promised this. It speaks of decades, of teachers, of temperament, of grace. And its literature is full of lifelong practitioners who describe the summit as rare. The evidence agrees. Baseline shifts are real and modest. Radical transformation is neither typical nor schedulable, and nobody selling it at scale has shown otherwise. Karma is cosmic bookkeeping for other people's misfortune. Using karma to explain away others' suffering, they must have deserved it, is epistemically groundless. Since nobody has access to the ledger and morally inverted, since the doctrine's stated function is to discipline your own conduct, not to audit your neighbors. The tradition's own ethicists condemn the move for centuries. So should its modern users. And this is the one item on this list I would call not just an error, but a corruption. Ancient astronauts and Vedic everything. Claims that the Vedas encode airplanes, nuclear physics or modern cosmology are pseudo-history. And they commit a strange self-injury. The text's actual achievements, Panini's grammar, still studied by linguists, the mathematics of the decimal place system, the logic of chapter 4, a phenomenology of mind that laboratories are still mining, are extraordinary. Burying real gold under fake gold is not reverence. It is the tale of someone who never inventoried the real gold. The practice, adopt the disciplined position as your standing posture in this territory and say it to yourself in 6 words when you need it. Strong on practice, honest on metaphysics. Ruthless on pseudoscience follows from both. That posture is not a modern compromise imposed on the tradition. It is the tradition as the logicians and the materialists built it, and holding it makes you a participant in the long argument rather than a customer of its gift shop. Begin. Theory ends here, and the tradition's verdict is unanimous across schools that agreed on nothing else. Understanding without practice is a map without a journey. So, a 30-day on-ramp, built from chapter 15, sized to fit an ordinary life. Days 1 to 7, the morning block at minimums. 1 minute of settling into the seat, 5 minutes of slow breath, 10 minutes of concentration on one object, the same object all month. In the evening, the 3-question review, nothing else, and especially nothing extra. The enemy of week 1 is ambition. Days 8 to 14, add the daytime layer, 1 sentence of intention before 1 significant task daily, and 1 guna check at a chosen transition. Choose your single ethical commitment for the month and define its 1 behavioral expression. Days 15 to 21, 5 minutes of inquiry or devotion after concentration. Routed by your chapter 13 answer. Begin the slow reading, 1 page of your chosen text daily, and let it be slower than feels productive. We slower than feels productive. Days 22 to 30. Extend concentration toward 15 or 20 minutes. If it is stable, and only if. On day 30, run the audit in the spirit of the logicians. What changed, by what evidence, in reactivity, sleep, focus, and the space between provocation and response. Then decide from data, not enthusiasm, whether to continue. If the month produces nothing, you have spent perhaps 11 hours and gained a first-hand basis for your skepticism, which Charvaka would salute. If it produces what the evidence says it typically produces, you will not need my encouragement to continue, and you will have joined in the only way that counts, the long argument this book was named for. The Brihadaranyaka Upanishad compresses the entire path into 1 instruction about the self. It is to be seen, to be heard, to be reflected on, to be meditated upon. Reading this book was the hearing. The rest was always going to be yours. When to seek help. This book is about philosophy and practice, and some suffering is neither. It is a medical condition. And for a medical condition, these practices are the wrong first tool. The full map is in the one who notices. The short version belongs here too. If for 2 weeks or more, you cannot work, sleep or eat. If pleasure has strained out of things that used to carry it. If reassurance from people who love you cannot land. if you are waking before dawn with the mind already racing, if you have ever had stretches of sleepless, racing highs, or if you are having thoughts of ending your life, the next step is a professional assessment, not a practice. And the practices can wait while the book keeps. If you are in crisis, findahelpline.com and befrienders.org will route you to your country's line or contact your local emergency number. If any of this is live for you, it comes before anything else in these pages. Practice index. Each chapter closes with one practice for finding them again. CH1. State the opposing position at full strength before answering it. CH2. One primary text three. Memorize the 8 words. Name one live want in them. CH4. The belief audit. Which Pramana delivered each belief that matters? Shi Hive Type 5 Decomposition. What is this actually made of? Before, what should I do? Shi Hive Price 6 Guna Checks at Transitions. Anger is present, not I am angry. Shi Hive Price 7 The 3 minute sit. Returns counted as reps. Shi One duty done completely, with the outcome deliberately unaudited. Shie, 9. The subtraction inquiry, the gratitude and release alternative. Shie, H, 10. One claim asked, what is the evidence and how would I know if false? Shie, 11. Specific gratitude delivered to a specific person and diffused. Shie, H, 12. One intense experience met with full attention instead of management. Shie, H, 13. Your faculty and your failure mode, one sentence each in writing. Shi-esh, 14. One yama or niyama, one behavioral expression, 1 month. Shi-esh, 15. The daily architecture itself. Shi-esh, 16. The 5 dharma moves on paper for one live decision. Shi-esh, 17. 2 minutes contemplating one dear thing as on loan, then go be with it. CH 18, the 4 box sort, practice, psychology, metaphysics, phenomenology. CH 19, expectations calibrated to evidence in writing before day 1. CH 20, 5 daily minutes of 4 in, 6 out, the sigh in your pocket. CH 21, the subtraction inquiry run with the scanner's findings in mind. CH 22, strong on practice, honest on metaphysics. Begin the 30 days, 3 seasons, 3 worked examples to copy or adapt. A season of clear seeing for the one who cannot not ask daily, the 3 minute sit weekly, one belief audit, chapter 4, and one Purva Paksha, an opposing position stated at full strength before answering chapter 1. Reading few verses of the Katha Upanishad slowly. Review question. Am I holding my beliefs by evidence or by habit? This is the logician season, and its mark of progress is not new opinions but looser grip on old ones. A season of practice for anyone starting from zero. Month 1, the 30 days of begin, exactly as written. Months 2 and 3, the full daily architecture of chapter 15, concentration extending toward 20 minutes, one niyama held with one behavioral expression, reading the Gita, one page a day. Review question, what is the space between provocation and response doing? A season of action, for the doer whose life is the practice ground, daily, the daytime layer of chapter 15, intention before one task, release after, weekly, one duty done completely and deliberately unaudited, chapter 8, and the 5 dharma moves on paper for any life decision, chapter 16. Reading the Thirukkural, a few couplets a day. Review question, how often did I demand the fruits? This is Karma Yoga season and it requires no cushion at all. Glossary. Advaita, non-dual Vedanta, Shankara school, Ahimsa, non-harm, Aparigraha, non-grasping, Apurva, the unseen potency of completed action, Mimamsa, Atman, the witnessing self, Bhakti, devotion, Brahman, the ground of reality, Charvaka, the materialist school, Darshana. School of philosophy, literally a way of seeing, Dharana, concentration, Dharma, order, duty, ethics, the right act, Dhyana, meditation, sustained flow of attention, Dvaita, dualist Vedanta, Madhva school, Guna, a strand of nature, Sattva, Rajas, Tamas, Janana, knowledge, Kaivalya, liberation as isolation of consciousness, Samkhya Yoga, Karma, action and its conditioning effects, Klesha, affliction, Maya, the misreading of reality, Advaita, Moksha, liberation, Nyaya, the school of logic, Prakriti, nature, including the mind, Pramana, a valid means of knowledge, Pranayama, breath, regulation, Pratipaksha, Bahana, cultivating the opposite, Pratyabhijna, recognition, Kashmir Shaivism, Purusha consciousness, the witness, Purusharthas, the four aims, Kama, Artha, Dharma, Moksha, Purvapaksha, the opponent's position, stated first, Samadhi, absorption, Samsara, the cycle of conditioned existence, Samskara, an impression or group, Santosha, contentment, Satya, truthfulness, Swadharma, one's own duty, Swadhyaya, self-study, Tapas, discipline, heat, Vairagya, non-attachment, Vedanta, the school of the Upanishads, Vishishtadvaita, qualified non-dual Vedanta, Ramanuja school, Vritti, a turning or fluctuation of the mind, Yama, restraint, Yoga, the school of practice, the stilling of the mind's turnings, on tradition and borrowing. This book takes a living tradition, one I was raised inside and practice within, and compresses it for a general reader, extracting practices from systems that were whole. The compression costs something real every time. The gunas without Samkhya's full cosmology are a mood tool. Within it, they are the fabric of nature. Surrender rendered as releasing outcomes is not the same act as surrender to a God who receives it. I have tried to mark these reductions where they happen rather than smooth them over and to point at the fuller thing. The traditions are alive, their teachers are teaching, and their texts are in print. If this book functions as a doorway rather than a substitute, it has done what I built it to do. If it functions as a substitute, that is a misuse. And the misuse is easier because of choices I made. The least I can do is name them. How this book was made, the substance of this book comes from my own reading, notes and practice, accumulated over years inside this tradition. I used AI tools to help draft and organize that material into prose, and then edited it, restructured it, and checked the claims. I stand behind what is here, and the errors that remain are mine, as with everything else in these pages. The method the book asks of you applies to the book itself. Read closely. Notice where claims are hedged and where they are not. Check the sources and weigh your own experience over my report of mine. That is the tradition standard, older than any of its books, and this one is happy to be held to it.